Welcome to the Breezy Breakfast. This week, Guelph MP Lloyd Longfell drops by remotely from Ottawa to give a federal update and to answer questions at the Rise and Shine on Mac Donnell. This discussion took place on October 19th.
Good morning, everyone. Today, Guelph MP Lloyd Longfield is our guest. He's going to give us a summary of what's been happening since the House rose in June. Then I will be asking questions that came in advance before turning to chat questions and questions from the restaurant. As we gather, we acknowledge that Ottawa is built on unceded Anishinaabe Algonquin territory. The peoples of the Anishinaabe Algonquin Nation have lived on this territory for millennia. Their culture and presence have nurtured and continue to nurture this land. The City of Ottawa honors the peoples and land of the Anishinaabe Algonquin Nation. The City of Ottawa honors all First Nations, Inuit, and Métis peoples and their valuable past and present contributions to this land. Thank you, Lloyd, for being our guest today. So what's been happening in Ottawa over the past few weeks?
Well, thanks, Tanya, and thanks for the group to continue these discussions. This is really democracy in action. My wife asked me this morning, so why are you doing this? And I said, well, this is where you find out what the community is doing. And I think her question was kind of like, you got in really late last night and now you're doing this. And aren't you supposed to be having breakfast about now? And I said, yeah, that's what I'm doing. I'm going to have breakfast with my friends in Guelph. So it's like every week there is a new massive crisis. It's been very hard on communities for sure. When we've looked at 3 weeks ago, it was anti-trans and gay demonstrations. And then 2 weeks ago, India had intervened in Canada and killed a Canadian citizen in Vancouver. And then the relationship of India and Canada became the issue and all of the things around that, which in my view boiled down to the rise of right-wing authoritarianism spilling into our borders. And then, of course, this past week, October 7th, with the crisis in Gaza with the Hamas, and again, a terrorist organization that isn't recognized as the leader of the Palestinians, but taking action in Palestine, and again, a breakdown of governance. That's one of the big concerns I've had, and I would say the last year or two, or maybe even going back to Donald Trump, was where are we at with Western democracy? So with that as an overlay of how do we have discussions? Why are these discussions important? And how do we listen to each other? How do we respect different views? And how do we keep democracy alive? It was great to see Poland electing a non-right-wing government, but then you see New Zealand slipping into a right-wing government. And this isn't liberal versus conservative. I think it's a style of governance that really can translate into liberal versus conservative, especially in Canada when it's one of those two parties that's governed the country. Of course, we have the other parties the discussions around, I know that there's some live discussions around how Parliament works in Canada. We saw that yesterday when the Speaker stood up to say we have to have better decorum, and he was shouted down by the Conservatives, and Pierre Poilievre wouldn't let him speak, and he's the Speaker. So he had to consult the table in front of him, the people that manage the legal aspects of the operation of the House of Commons, to say, no, I am within my rights to say I am the Speaker, and I'm going to say we need to do a better job of handling democracy in these chambers, in the chamber that we're working in, but as well as committee rooms. And we have to do a way better job of democracy in Canada, given what's going on globally. And so we are trying to improve the level of discussion in Parliament, and something in my 8 years I've been trying to do through example, but also calling out. that attacking other people and attacking parties, not cool. Attacking ideas, that's what we're there for. So the big ideas that we're working on, really since we've been coming out of COVID, slipping back into COVID, but at the other side of the lockdowns, I'll say, is the economy, making sure that the economy is recovering, which the jobs have been recovered, the economy, we can see wages are growing again. But we also see that inflation has been the issue, and that's been something we've been dealing with, is the effects of inflation. And then working with the Bank of Canada, the Bank of Canada being independent of us, which is a wonderful form of governance in Canada, that banks are actually public institutions that are managed outside of government, very different from a lot of countries. They've got a goal of getting inflation between 2 and 4%. It was good to see this week that it's dropped to 3.8, still on the high end of the range that they've been given. And their tool to get inflation down to between 2 and 4% is to increase interest rates to try and slow the economy without putting us into recession and job losses and all of those things. So we've been dealing in Parliament with how do we respond to the high interest rates without fueling inflation to try and thread the needle. And that takes the form of supports for vulnerable people, people that are really being affected by interest rate hikes, people that have mortgages that have to go into renewals, and then the cost of housing in general. So the bill that we have before us in the House right now, Bill C-56, is about affordability. So that's one of the main themes that we've been working on is affordability. Another one is housing. Related, but not directly. You know, there are other things around housing in terms of homelessness and creating supply of housing, which well, I'll talk about just briefly as well. And then, of course, climate change. The climate crisis continues on. We saw Canada burning this past summer. We have around the world climate events that are happening. Or weather events that are happening as a result of climate change. And so the climate change continues. So we're trying to fix all of these problems while the world is burning. So not an easy thing. And while governance isn't really where it needs to be, because there are serious problems that have to be dealt with serious discussions. And the type of political rhetoric coming to us from the United States through the Conservatives is really starting to pick at me. I don't talk this way a lot, but I'm starting to talk more and more because it really is getting in the way of us solving some problems that we have to solve. And working with across parties, working with Canadians at different levels. So the affordability C-56 has been delayed in the House by about 3 weeks now. Different procedural tactics being used to not get Bill C-56, which is an affordability act that is to remove GST on purpose-built housing around rental units. Just us signaling we're going to do that has opened some rental unit construction in Canada. When we actually get the bill through the Senate and get it enacted, hopefully before Christmas, we will be able to have a better construction season next year around getting more apartment supply in Canada. Bill C-56 also has some changes to the Competition Act, and that's focusing on the five main grocers in Canada that are acting as a monopoly, and how do we introduce better competition in Canada to allow small grocery chains or small independent grocery stores even to be able to compete against the big five and try and drive down prices through competition. And and if not, then what do we do to step in and take, tax measures to say to the large chains, you can't do this, you can't make these record profits on the backs of Canadians. So I was heartened 2 weeks ago. I do the groceries in the house, and on Thanksgiving weekend, I went to Food Basics where I do a lot of the groceries and saw markdown tickets on almost all the items. I have a spreadsheet on everything. So I use only the MasterCard for groceries, and I only buy groceries using a charge card so I can keep track of groceries. And my grocery bill had gone up by about $15 a week over the last 3 months. And I saved about $11 at Food Basics on Thanksgiving. So I thought, okay, well, it does have some, there's some change. I'm going to keep watching it every week and every month to see where we're at. But that's what we're intending to do, is to get grocery prices down and then putting it into legislation to make sure that we have better competition in Canada. So there's a vote that's just been put on my calendar this morning that's probably going to limit debate again because there's some delays on debate on C-56 so that we can get it to committee and get it through the House. And so that's happening in real time. So affordability, broadly speaking, you know, how do we help Canadians to pay their bills without feeling inflation? How do we make sure that the money is getting to the vulnerable people and not to the people that don't need the money? And other affordability issues like childcare that we've introduced and the $10 a day early learning and childcare programs that are rolling out or have rolled out. And then PharmaCare, which we've done for vulnerable Canadians. The NDP is really pushing us to go further on broad-based PharmaCare, which involves the provinces. We may get to a point of having at least a framework done on that, but getting it through the provinces, knowing how difficult it was to get early learning and childcare through, is going to be it's a challenge. Because unlike Manitoba, which I can proudly say has elected an NDP premier, which was awesome to see, we have so many conservative premiers that are really pushing against what we're trying to do. And so not easy to deal with all of, you know, but childcare was a big one. Dental care is another one. Doing things to help seniors, doing the grocery rebates and what we can do to help. Housing, a big one for Guelph, and it's great to have Councillor Ault on the call. I've been working with the mayor and with MPP Schreiner on housing. We've had several successful projects in Guelph. We were at Silver Maples together last week and or a couple weeks ago. So we've got some seniors housing that we were able to get across the line in Guelph. We've got the Delhi project that's now become public, and we'll see some more supportive housing in Guelph. We've got a few other projects in the wind. I'm trying to get across the line with a possible co-op opportunity in Guelph. But we have the Housing Accelerator Fund, which is the big one that we've been working on together. And the mayor and I have had a conversation even yesterday about where we're at with that. We've responded to some of the concerns that the Minister of Housing federally has asked us to look at, things like fourplexes, and that we're looking at across Canada. And City Council has responded to that, and I think we're coming into a good space there. CAM's going to be in Ottawa on Monday, and he's in front of the Finance Committee to talk about housing. They've called him in, and he said to me, how did that happen? And I said, I had nothing to do with it. This time, I had nothing to do with it. But they would have seen that the Housing Accelerator Fund was announced in Guelph by the Prime Minister. And so they're bringing CAM in to talk about housing affordability in front of the Finance Committee. So very active. We hope to see something landing soon. We've seen it in London. We've seen it in Halifax. We've seen different cities across Canada getting access to the Housing Accelerator Fund, money that will help us to build more houses in Guelph by having more support at City Hall, as well as some tools that they can use around zoning that City Council can use around zoning to help us get more houses built in Guelph. So that is, you know, there is progress there. It's never fast enough. Winter's coming. I can see from our place an encampment that has started using fire because it's cold in the mornings. And then I read in the news from Ottawa yesterday that one of the encampments, not the one across from us, but one on York Road, I think it was, that had a fire yesterday. So we need to try and help people get to a better place. And that involves mental health supports, which we've got some good support in Guelph, and working with Wyndham House, who got, I think, $1.2 million from the federal government, working with Stonehenge, the community health center, to help people that are in a bad spot because mental health and addictions, and sometimes that results in homelessness. And so we're trying to get to some of the root cause of homelessness in Guelph. Some good progress on youth homelessness. I think we've reduced it by about 50% in Guelph, but we are still seeing people coming in from Toronto. And even last week, we had some people come in from Toronto that from one of the diasporas that has not typically been in Guelph, but I guess there's a few people in Guelph saying, come on to Guelph and you'll be looked after. And then people are homeless because there's nothing for them here. So working with Gail and at Stepping Stone and others that are trying to help people that are coming to Guelph that really have nowhere to stay. And in housing, I'll also say we're looking at the international students. You know, the University of Guelph has about 7% international. Conestoga's over 50% international students, which I've heard numbers as high as 88%. I haven't confirmed that number. But then there's the private colleges that have now been really opened up by the province, and that's causing about 900,000 people potentially in the coming year coming for to be international students in Canada to colleges that aren't accredited sometimes. And there's a bit of a mess that we have to work on with the province on private colleges that we are seized with as well. And finally, on environment, and that continues, and I'm on the environment committee. Had supper with the environment minister two nights ago and talking about what's coming up. We have a study on water coming through the environment committee. It connects to the boiled water advisories that we've been working on with First Nations. I've been up in Sioux Lookout. I was at the Bay of Quinte, the Mohawk Nation, not this last summer, but the summer before. I was up in Bruce Peninsula with the Saun Nation, the Saugeens Nation up there, and also with the Chippewas of the Nawash Nation. And the Chippewas have a boiled water advisory, which has resulted in having to get a new water treatment plant, but also change all the piping in their community, and at the same time getting fiber optics into the community. And that project is, we were hoping to see it finished by the end of this year. It's, you know, they had some further delays over the summertime, but they're dealing with that. And I would say that the boiled water advisories, which I think is one of the topics of discussion, is, you know, we've got each project identified. I think there's 26 left. Each project has a timeline. We know what has to be done within the community. Some have been completed that we're waiting for bound councils to approve and say that we are past the risk point that created the boiled water advisories. But we continue to have boiled water advisories coming on. And so we had some numbers on that I can share later. And so we're doing a water study, and there was an elder, I think I've mentioned it to this group, when I was up in Sioux Lookout, one of the elders said to me, stop poking holes in Mother Earth and we don't need to worry about boiled water advisories. And I took that back, and really my translation of that is, if we start with clean water in the first place, we don't need to be doing, you know, spending billions of dollars on treatment plants. So our water study is going to look at what can we do to tighten water regulations and make sure that we're starting with clean water in the first place, which, I mean, he stated the obvious, and I love it when people just, that was it, you know, just don't have dirty water, and then we don't have boiled water advisories. So it sounded pretty obvious. But he is, his nation and all the Nan nations up there are within the Ring of Fire. And so there's mining developments being planned in that area. And so it's really important we act quickly to get on top of that before we make matters worse. And so environment, climate change, we have that. We also have biodiversity coming up. And I think we've put in a lot of legislation that now we are looking at, you know, where are we at? And also I was in a meeting yesterday with the Commissioner of Environment and Sustainability with Jerry DeMarco, and he was at our environment committee, and I think it was yesterday, I never know anymore, it was this week anyway, I think it was 2 days ago maybe, and he's moved up his audit of our environment policies, and the results from our environment policies is moved up by a year. And so he said that we should be seeing something within the next 6 months coming from his audits on how our climate change programs are working or not working, which is the more interesting part of that, because he said, if I can move it up by a year, we can do some course corrections. So a few years ago during COVID, the worst part of COVID, when we were all on Zoom, we did the Net Zero Accountability Act at the Environment Committee that I was very heavily involved with. And part of that was to bake in the accountability through audits through his office. So we were concerned that we wouldn't see audits for a while, but it's great to see. He said he's going to lead by example. And so a lot of our legislation is already in place for climate change, but we are looking at biodiversity and we are looking at water as an issue coming forward. So I'll leave it at that. I mean, I could keep going on, but it's assisted dying legislation is coming forward. We talked about that yesterday at our caucus meeting. We are going to be constituting a panel reconstituting a panel on assisted dying. By March 17th, they're supposed to report back. We'll likely have to get an extension on assisted dying as it relates to people with mental health challenges. And the Supreme Court has given us directions that we have to go back to the table on that. We also have the Supreme Court opinion that came back to us on our Impact Assessment Act that I was also involved with, and sounds like a pattern here. We have to fix some of that legislation. The Supreme Court said that there's some provincial concerns that around consultation that we have to address. So we're going to have to redo parts of Bill C-69, and that'll be coming to our committee in the coming year as well. But the good thing is, he said, yeah, the federal government is totally within their rights to have impact assessment legislation. The way you've done it has to be changed. And that's why the Supreme Court is there. They're part of Parliament. They test. I'm not a lawyer. We put out ideas. We listen to Canadians. We come up with legislation. They tell us whether it passes muster with the laws of the land. And so they said, go back and rework some of that. So that's what we'll be doing in the early new year. Okay, enough about me.
I'm going to go to some of the questions that were asked in advance. So the first one is, does the Liberal caucus regret not implementing some form of proportional representation now that it appears that the PCs are on track to win a majority government with only 39% of the vote?
Well, whenever there's a sentence that includes a phrase that the PCs are on track to win a majority government, it should make all of our blood run cold. I think in terms of proportional representation, I think I've spoken to this group about this before as well. The process, I think, was flawed from the beginning, that we tried to do this as parliamentarians from the House of Commons. And we have a stake in the results of what comes forward. And the Conservatives really wanted a national referendum. We didn't want to do that because we said it would kill the process. We gave away majority on the committee. They were able to put something forward around a national referendum that we really said was a non-starter. So we couldn't agree on how to go about getting to proportional representation. Since then, and with a lot of thinking, scratching my head, I think there's a discussion about citizen assembly as well. That's from some corners. We've heard about that. And my thoughts on that is that the Senate is the elected citizens assembly that is nonpartisan for the most part now, and they represent all parts of the country. They represent Indigenous people as well. And out of 103 senators, I think we're down to 15 conservatives that are still related to a party. The rest of them are independent. And within the independent senators, there's different groups of independent senators. The Senator Black is part of one of the groups, as an example. So I think, if my advice to Canadians that want to see it go forward is, let's try and get the Senate working on it as they are on universal basic income, which is another one of the questions. The Senate is doing fabulous work. What we're getting back from the Senate, three quarters of the time we take their amendments, just go. because they do the research. Sometimes there's some nuances that, you know, for other reasons, we can't go ahead with some of what the Senate asked for. But I think we have a really good, really well-functioning Senate, and we need to embrace that and use it. So I'd love to see my preference is ranked ballot, and we've used that for the speaker just recently, and we ended up with the first Black speaker in Canada, and probably would never have happened without having a ranked ballot system in place. The Conservatives were absolutely shocked when the results came in. They thought they had the votes, and turned out because of the ranked system, the proportionality kicked in, and different parties decided together that this would be the best speaker we could have. We could apply that across the board, or we could do some other proportional form. But I would love to see that coming to us from the Senate. And you look at the states, and that becomes the example of what not to do. They can't even elect a speaker right now because of their partisanship. We have a ranked ballot in that part of our process that works really well, and we were able to get a speaker elected within 3 days of losing a speaker, within a week of losing a speaker. We have a fabulous speaker in place, and he's going to make some changes. So it's a live discussion, but the way partisanship works in the House of Commons, or doesn't work in the House of Commons, I'd say steer clear of the House of Commons on that discussion, because it's going to go nowhere.
Speaking of senators, the Toronto Star reports that Senator Kim Pate's proposal to investigate guaranteed basic income following the clear success of the CERB program will be considered by the Senate Finance Committee. Does it have any chance of success amongst your Liberal MP colleagues in the long term?
Yeah, I think we saw that, you know, when we did some emergency response during COVID, and we used the employment insurance system to get money to Canadians through that way, we overrode some provincial legislation, which is typically around labor and wages and things like that. But we used the tools we had through the Employment Insurance Act. I'd love to see us getting creative around that. I can't say what could be supported until I see what's coming. I'm really glad that they're discussing it, because we saw a massive benefit across the board to Canadians. And the surprise was, surprise, surprise, the economy did so much better when people had money. Go figure. And also some of the social problems were at least alleviated for a short period of time. And now we're back into people having trouble with rent and groceries. And so universal basic income, I know the Wynne government in Ontario was doing some pilot work that got killed by the Conservatives when they came in. BC is looking at some things, but I think nationally we do need to have the discussion. I'm really glad to see that the Senate's going to lead the discussion, and then they're going to force the discussion on us, because once they pass their bill, it comes to the House. It comes in backwards, but we have to deal with it. So it'll be a very interesting debate when it comes.
Indeed, it will. I'm going to go to a totally different topic. Child marriage continues to be legal in Canada, so children are forced into marriages by their parents. The UN position is that child-enforced marriage is a human rights violation, and it disproportionately affects women and girls, and it prevents them from living their lives free from all forms of violence. When will your government raise the age of marriage to 18 or 19 years old?
That question surprised me. That's not a question I've had. I've had the voting age question, but not the marriage question. I think in terms of the marriage question, if you're under 18, you need to have guardian's consent. So there is some sorts of protection, which unless the parents are the ones forcing you into a marriage, which could happen. The issue around, when I read the question, I thought there's another part, a similar argument around trans kids being able to be who they are, and so the rights, it's kind of an opposite argument, that the rights of students in high school to be able to express their gender is apart from what their parents are telling them. is one of the questions. The human rights of children comes into that discussion. So this could fairly easily go into a human rights discussion that a 16-year-old would have the right to make decisions for themselves. And so I don't think this would be a slam dunk on either side when it comes into human rights, and also that marriage is within provincial jurisdictions, generally speaking. It's an interesting discussion point, but I would go back to the human rights of the 16-year-old, and how do you protect their rights in this discussion? And so I would say that if the issue is forced marriage, that's already illegal in Canada. And that, you know, the enforcement of that law would be something that would be more to the point of the discussion, is how do we protect people wanting to be married from being forced into marriage. That was okay, a long answer. So I'm not doing well shortening my answers.
These are hard questions to give short answers to. For example, this one. The Liberal government has strongly condemned the Hamas terrorist attacks on Israelis, but not the IDF's ongoing attacks on Palestinians. Given several reliable sources, I'm not sure which ones, are confirming that the IDF is committing war crimes and genocide, how can the Liberals continue to take this stance? And that is not, the stance would be not saying anything about the IDF.
Yeah, I think, I mean, first of all, the statement in the House on Monday by the Prime Minister that Hamas is not Palestine, that they're a terrorist organization and has to be dealt with as a terrorist organization. And there's a group of terrorist organizations in the Middle East and elsewhere that are taking over the form of legitimate governance. Working with our allies, of course, I mean, Canada has to be, as we do with Ukraine, we have to be working with our allies on the diplomatic front. But in this case, it was good to see yesterday that the United States is going to really push for humanitarian aid to be flowing and not blocking humanitarian aid. It's a complex. I'm going to be going to the mosque on Friday to hear from them where they're at. I'm reaching out to the Jewish community in Guelph. Everybody's hurting right now. And I think our role, first of all, is to try and keep the temperature down so that Canadians are not attacking Canadians, that we don't have people afraid to send their kids to school with anything with Palestine on the shirt, or we're afraid to send our kids to school if they're wearing a kippah. We have to keep this level of discussion beyond the outrage that we're all feeling to say, what's the human rights here that we're trying to protect, and how can we make sure that we do that? So that's first and foremost, I think, where we need to go with that. That whole discussion is we need to acknowledge the hurt that people that are Palestinian or Libyan now, and they're not part of a terrorist organization, but they're being looked at as if they are. Or the Israelis in the same way that are caught up in this whole thing. So that it's a day by day, and it's not an easy one. But I think at the root, we have to make sure that Canadians are not putting themselves in jeopardy by hate speech and by attacks on mosques or synagogues or in schools, and particularly in schools. We've had a discussion at our caucus meeting yesterday morning that was very emotional. We had a caucus meeting Monday night, again, with the Jewish members of our caucus and the Muslim members of our caucus. It's very emotional. There were a lot of tears in the room with stories about family or kids in their schools that are being singled out by other kids in the schools. So we have to fight down terrorism, and we do that by good governance. And good governance in this case means we have to work on diplomatic solutions and humanitarian solutions, first of all, and get past the attacking terror with terror.
So someone has asked, what about the human toll in Gaza? Doesn't the blockade of Gaza by Israel raise the temperature, you know, put on the heat? I believe that the border is also blocked by Egypt. So that doesn't help much either.
No, and the Americans are getting involved. And I have visited the region as a member of parliament a few years ago. I was in the West Bank. I was in Jerusalem. I went to the Knesset. I visited the innovation centers in Tel Aviv, which were amazing. I went to Palestine as well and talked with our offices in Palestine. And you can clearly see when you cross the border the oppression that the Palestinians are under. The immediately our vehicle was shot at by pellet guns. They looked like real guns. They could have been real guns. It was kids shooting at us with pellet guns. When you oppress a people and you apply apartheid, you get bad results. And at the end of the day, it shows the importance of good governance. And hopefully, I keep going back to that because that is the threat that the world is under right now. Is authoritarian regimes, regardless of where they are in the world, they're popping up all over the place and bad results.
Okay,
so it was very interesting to see, though. In fact, the war in Syria was really going on when I was there, and I saw the gunfire from where we were at in a relatively safe place, although we were on the other side of bulletproof glass, on the outside of bulletproof glass, and the UN forces I was with said, behind us is the bulletproof glass, and I said, so why aren't we behind us right now? But they weren't shooting directly at us, but we could see the gunfire going on in Syria, and what the Israelis would do is... regardless of which side was wounded, they would bring them into the hospitals, treat them, and send them back to Syria. And the Israelis were agnostic on what side they were. If they were injured, they would look after them. So I did see some very unusual things when I was there. That if they're shooting at you one day and you put them in your hospitals and fix them up and send them back, then they shoot at you the next day. But it's a very strange part of the world that. Yeah, it has been for a long time. Anyway, sorry, I keep going on. 8:40.
That's quite all right. That is a very complex region of the world, and
but terrorism, regardless of where terrorism is, it has to be called out, and we have to be able to hold them to account, and without endangering civilian lives. And that's the key thing, as you said. When they mix themselves intentionally, because they have no regard for human life, they mix themselves intentionally with kids or hospitals, it just makes that job even harder. But on the plus side, Canada has been doing an amazing job of getting people out. The Canadian Armed Forces are putting themselves in harm's way. And our evacuations that we've been doing daily, we're way ahead of the world on getting Canadians out. And getting them to Greece. And now we're going to be stepping up efforts in Lebanon. I got some briefing notes on that this morning to say to anybody in Lebanon that's Canadian to get out, or before we have to airlift you out using Canadian Armed Forces personnel.
I am going to ask one more question. One person is interested in hearing about progress on adopting the draft defense policy.
I'd have to look that one up. I know we've put a strong, secure, and engaged policy in place. The investments that we're making in military have been very, targeted towards giving our personnel the best equipment they can have when they're in harm's way. We're also working on recruitment and building up our forces to meet our NATO commitments. There was some media around the Treasury Board asking for a reduction of 1.5%. Every department's being asked for taking 1.5% out of their bureaucracy through reducing consultant fees or other administrative fees. But we do have a scaled a budget for defense that goes to 2025, I believe. Which is scaling up our spend to try and meet our international commitments. So the armed forces is going through a lot of review right now in terms of personnel and how personnel are treated, and especially women. But I don't know that review that was mentioned, so I'd have to get back on that. Somebody send me something in writing and I can do the research and get back to you if you've got a question about it.
Great. So One more question, and then I'm going to turn it over to Phil.
Uh-oh.
Given the Supreme Court decision on the validity of federal environmental assessments, how can the feds hinder the rapidity that Premier Ford wants in constructing the Highway 413 and the Bradford bypass?
We still, I mentioned this in my preamble, that we have some changes to make to Bill C-69. Our intention is, we have other acts that can apply to 413 or to the Greenbelt in general around biodiversity. And we can always go back to biodiversity loss, and which triggers an assessment in itself. Our goal to protect 30% of our land and water by 2030, we are well on track to do that. I think we should be at 25% by the end of this year. The Green Belt would be an obvious backstep on that whole progress that we're making. So we will be reviewing that legislation quickly, so that we're as quickly as we can to get it right, and then go back to the Supreme Court from there. But even the threat that we were going to do that, I think our threat of putting in an environment assessment was one of the main reasons that the province went, we've been losing at the Supreme Court every time. I think he feels emboldened now, because the Supreme Court opinion, it wasn't a ruling, it was actually an opinion, was that you better change some parts of the act in terms of consultations. And so we're identifying that. What was said in the House yesterday by Minister Wilkinson was we're going to do a surgical correction of C-69. We're not going back to the drawing board, but there's some places that we have to improve. But when it comes to 413, biodiversity loss and the biodiversity legislation that's coming, we'll tighten that up even more.
Thank you very much, Lloyd. And now I'm going to turn it to Phil with some questions from the restaurateurs.
Thank you very much. We have a few questions here. Just before we get going, regards to the Middle East, the Middle Eastern situation is incredibly complicated and is further clouded by a tremendous amount of misinformation and confusion. Having studied this for many, many years, both at the undergraduate and the graduate level, I can appreciate that news sources need to be examined carefully. Should anybody actually wish to get a sense of the challenges that are faced in Palestine, one needs, first of all, to understand the relationship between Shia and Sunni Muslim, as well as the understanding of the situation of as a holy city by three significant religions, and recognize as well that often news is filtered. There are, however, some very, very good news sources out there, and some people might not even be aware of them. Snopes, for example, is excellent for confirming and refuting what oftentimes would appear to be fact, but oftentimes are also misinformation. We need to be very, very careful about that. And just, Lloyd, you might want to comment on this as well. The one area that I would point out is that at this point, there is still no clear evidence what happened in the bombing of the hospital that has been operated by the Church of England. We just don't know. So we need to be very, very careful about any sort of specific comments related to any organizations, any groups within the Middle East. What we do know is that this is a human tragedy in the Middle East, and it is not getting better.
So yeah, I'd say on the plane last night, I was reading a Reuters article about just that, around the source of the missiles that went into the hospital, and whether it was a misfire or what it was. Clearly, people are going to be using this for all kinds of different purposes. Well, the purpose is to enrage and divide people, and we need to get back to the human rights and knowing that terrorism just can't be accepted. Reuters is one of the news sources I use on these international things versus American news media.
Housing and affordability and all that stuff has been kind of overshadowed this week. Trying to get my head around the propaganda around what happened in Gaza and Israel, I want to say that part of the complication has been made complicated when it didn't need to be. It's hard to get facts out of a place. It's 25 miles long, I believe, and about 7 miles at the widest point, with what used to be 2 million people in it, over half of which was children. Also that the borders to Gaza have been blocked. So Israel has total control over water, over food, over hydro, never mind the basics to rebuild infrastructure that has been destroyed by bombs. Thank you, Lloyd, for actually dealing with this issue. I appreciate that. And I appreciate you trying to remain as unbiased as possible. I will say, going back to something you said way earlier, that we need to get back to decorum in, in Parliament, in the House of Commons. I think there's a false equivalency between people just yelling and attacking and stopping other people from talking, and having clear, honest, good faith debate about issues. And I think I've been saying for ages, we need to have hard conversations and we need to get better at them. That's it.
Yeah. So, and the example for the House of Commons should be an example, not of how leadership should manage the tough situations and have those respectful disagreements and get to a better place. And right now it's pretty hard to find examples anywhere in the world where you can have respectful disagreements and can still continue to function, because we still need to build homes. We still need to help people that are facing a winter of cold right now. And we need to acknowledge that we've got other big problems like climate change, that we're like all these wars that are popping up all over. Some of them are the result of climate change if you're in the sub-Sahara Africa. And then the people that are coming from war zones, coming to Canada, coming to Guelph with trauma, and a lot of the kids with trauma that are in schools that are having to try and get into a new frame of life where we're living in a, they're living in a peaceful country where, you know, they're not afraid for their life when they go home. So, how do you have those conversations to reassure people that, democracy works, that we are in a safe country? We do have challenges around police forces or around enforcement of laws. Some laws have to change because they're unjust. The treatment of missing and murdered and Indigenous women and girls, that was another question out there. It was so good to see Wab Kanu being elected. I think we can start moving forward on, I was in Winnipeg for a football game on Labor Day. We went home and to see one of the U of G alumni play for the Bombers, and they won. They beat Saskatchewan, which is amazing. But all the news was around the landfill, and the election platform was around the landfill. So there's an example where we could disagree if you want to disagree about it, but moving forward, the majority of people want to see justice served, and that we never go back down those roads again where Indigenous people are oppressed the way we have for over 100 years. Sorry, I keep going on, but you're right. We have to have these types of forums, like these coffee shop discussions have to be at a place where I've had to start carrying a security device. You know, the House of Commons monitors my movement now, because there could be somebody with an F. Trudeau flag that wants to punch my lights out or worse. We've got to get past that.
Thanks, Lloyd. I think you're right. A certain decorum and civility needs to be restored, not just within the House of Commons, but throughout society as well.
Yep.
I know that there is going to be ostensibly a parents' rights protest in Guelph this weekend, and I think there are many people saying that there could be violence at that. And
yeah.
I would urge everyone to please maintain our sense of civility, whether we agree or disagree. There is no room for threats and violence. I'm going to pass it over to Glenn to talk about water.
Greetings, Floyd. And Thank you for your time. I'd like to bring up the point about the boiled water situation on our native communities. And I had suggested this to you several years ago, back before COVID, that what I would like to see happen as a gesture to our First Nations people is that on Canada Day, instead of all the money that we spend on celebrations on Parliament Hill and various things around the country, the government spending, that they take that money and put it towards building the infrastructure that is needed to clean up these boiled water situations on our Inuit and our Native Indigenous, I guess is the word I'm looking for, in our Indigenous communities.
Yeah, thanks, Glenn. In terms of the Canada Day celebrations, I think you've seen have really changed over the last few years since the residential school discovery of unmarked graves. Canada Day celebrations really are a mixed message now of recognizing that we aren't the great country that we always said we were, that we still have a long ways to go. But having said that, we're still a really, really good country that is working on its issues. But in terms of the boiled water advisory budget, it's $1.6 billion and needs to be more and continues, as we say, well, we have to add pipes now, so you have to add that cost. Then training you have to add, and we have to add that cost. We are also spending on housing, and while we're doing all of the water work, then we can put in infrastructure for housing, and which we're doing up in Bruce Peninsula at the Chippewas. I don't think it's an either or, Glenn. I think I said that at the time. I think we need to find a way that Canadians can come together on our national day to have those discussions about what's great about Canada and what needs to be worked on. And I think those are very valuable. I think they're valuable to the country and worth investing in, but I think we can't do it at the cost of other things. I don't think we would be transferring money from our boiled water programs to Canada Day celebrations, but I think we need to do both. I don't think it's either or, but we are in some challenging times that we, you know, right now, this next budget that we're going to see is going to be, we have to start reducing or continue to reduce some of the programs that we put in place for COVID and look at other ways of doing things that because we can't continue to run up the deficit. We're not going to a balanced budget as the Conservatives are asking us to, because we're not there yet, but the economy will help us get there when it grows. But no, I think we need to continue to celebrate, but in a different way. We need to recognize our faults as well.
I have a quick question for Lloyd. Please update us on Canada's subsidies to oil and gas.
Sure. The fossil fuel subsidies in Canada and also our international fossil fuel subsidies are eliminated virtually. There's one or two that have a timeline attached to their elimination. There is a cap that will be coming forward that we're working on the oil and gas industry. So that will, and we've also, so we've eliminated any non-efficient subsidies, and there's some definitions around that. And then we've also we're putting in place some things around the money that the oil and gas industry is making and in terms of taxation on that. So we are putting some financial pressure on it, but the subsidies, we did a study in the Environment Committee and there's a report out there on the subsidy programs. I talked to the minister about that actually when we had supper on Tuesday night, and he said, yeah, we're there now. That's as far as he's concerned, the subsidy programs have been eliminated.
Yeah. It's Rob Morris. I'm a volunteer director of the Canadian Alliance of British Pensioners, and I want to cover this under the cost of living crisis. There's 127,000 in Canada, 60,000 of which are in Ontario, but in the Guelph and surrounding area, there's 15,000, and their pensions have been depreciated by 20% over the last 12 months. And I want to thank you for your letter that you wrote me supporting the cause. And I want to talk about Canada taking the high road to support these people who are in welfare difficulty. But the cost to the Canadian economy has just gone up from $490 million a year to $720 million due to the pension increases that have been offered in the UK. The two messages I wanted to leave to you today were, one, the word parity is a dangerous word. The definition of it has changed over the last 20 or 30 years. We're not asking anything that hasn't been done in 55 other countries. It's basically index linking going forward and no respect for going backwards. And secondly, I know you sit in the House very close to James Maloney, and I wrote to him yesterday, and I'd very much like to encourage you to have a brief chat with him, because the support we're getting from the Canadian government on this is very, very good. We have a delegation in London coming up in mid-November, and James Maloney will be over there as well. Yep. And we're closer than we've ever been before. So anything you can do to encourage the government to keep the goodwill going forward is much appreciated.
Yeah, that's great. And James is chair of the Canada-UK parliamentary group, and it's going over because of that. And thanks for bringing that forward. We'll continue working on it. I was first made aware of that before politics, where a friend of mine had moved over from the UK and told me about that issue. And then you brought it forward to me when I got elected. So, yeah, there's some equity issues there that we definitely need to continue to work on.
UK pensioners who are Canadian citizens sat in the restaurant this morning.
I really appreciate these conversations, you guys, and we are taking notes from our side. I'm sorry I didn't get to the 19 in the chat, or 25 now in the chat, but we'll copy and paste those over. Let's keep ourselves connected. I really do value these conversations.
Thank you, Lloyd, for being here to answer our questions. And if I can get the questions that were not addressed, I will send them to you.
Sounds great. Thanks, Tanya. Stay well, everybody.
So I'm going to just throw it open, right? We can talk about whatever we want.
Just a couple of comments. Two things that I'd like to make remarks on are both city budget and some of the decisions that we've made recently. I would encourage everybody to please be engaged in budget discussions this year. You might be aware the city of Hamilton is looking at about a 14% increase in their property taxes because of the downloading that has occurred from the provincial government as a consequence of Bill 23. What that means is that development charges that were normally assigned to builders developing subdivisions are being reduced substantially. And that means that cities like Guelph have a millions of dollar deficit to cover. In the case of Guelph, it's about $227 million, I believe. That means amortized over 10 years, which is what we're projecting, we're looking at an average of $22.7 million to recovery, which equals a substantial percentage of your taxes, approximately 5% on top of what other reasonable tax increases might occur to provide infrastructure, water support, roads, amenities, so on and so forth. This will be a challenge for us, and I think that your input to your councillors is absolutely essential. One other point I just realized I should probably get to before I go further. Erin Caton is somewhere online, and she'd wanted to ask questions about accessibility and disability. Regrettably, we did not get to those. But Erin, if you're there, I would love to hear from you on what your concerns are, what their relationship is to the federal government, and perhaps also a local perspective as well.
So unfortunately, Erin is no longer on the line. However, hey. I will reach out to her and ask her what her concerns were, and I will send it in the email with the other questions that we couldn't get to. I will send it to Lloyd.
Thank you. And maybe we can consider as an accessibility, disability breezy breakfast. I think it's an area that we have missed in the past, and it would be lovely to hear from some of those people who are advocating for greater accessibility in Guelph. The other point was just a particular one. Some of you might have been a bit mystified when I voted against a student residence on the corner of Stone Road and Gordon Street. This is a 1,000 student private residence that's going in. It butts up against the residential area, and I had no foundations within the Planning Act to vote against it. And yet I did. And I did it for one simple reason, and harkens back to something that happened at the university in the 1980s. And that was the death of a student who decided to try jumping between the pods of the South residence after he'd had a night of merrymaking associated with alcohol that was actually available within student residences at that point at the University of Guelph. The decision at that point was that the university would no longer have alcohol available in its restaurants in residences, and reduced alcohol sales and consumption in the university substantially, which was probably a good move. It's led to a lot of alcohol being served downtown on a Friday or Saturday night, as we are aware, as Guelph is in some senses a party city. But there are proposals to license the terraces in this particular private student residence, which does not carry with it the same levels of support that the university provides. There are no residence dons in this building. It is, for all intents and purposes, defined as an apartment. Yet, as I've said, if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's a student residence, and it's a private student residence as well. So I thought the only way to make my point known was to vote against something that I had no foundation for. They had crossed their T's and dotted their I's, but I decided, what the heck? If we're going to make anything of the challenges of drinking, and I'm guilty, and Robert over there is guilty, and John's guilty of having a pint every once in a while, it's not anti-alcohol. This is about student behavior in a residence where the average age is probably about 19 years, and there are many people under that age who maybe are thinking more with their hormones than anything else. So I decided, what the heck, I'll take a stand on this one. So those are my two issues, which hopefully will have filled up a bit of time, Tanya.
We were talking today about the situation in Israel, and then we were talking about the protests that will be going on this Saturday. And I think it's interesting that the fact that many of the people who are concerned about material in school being age inappropriate, many of the people who are driving that, who are protesting against that, are actually Muslims. And they are not protesting it in a spirit of hate. So I think that this is a much more nuanced discussion should be had. That's something that I've noticed.
And I don't disagree with you, Tanya, that the nuances are essential. But hearing from Lloyd about civility in the House of Commons also reminds me that we need to reestablish what was once the civility that we had. And when I am extremely concerned about threats, about occupations, and about what we saw in Ottawa some time ago, and the fact that this, quote, parental rights protest is actually not about parental rights, but is about anything under the sun that is anti-X, anti-Trudeau, anti-electric cars, anti-this, that, and the other. And it has been founded on the fallacy of parental rights, which do not exist. And I want to be very clear on that. We have human rights. But I also have a couple of people here that want to say things as well.
Certainly. But before you go to those people, I would just like to say that I don't think it's fair to lump everybody together. That's what I want to say.
Thank you for your opinions, Tanya. The fact is, there are adult rights and there are children's rights. Both adults and children have human rights. Adults do not have rights over children. Therefore, this conversation should never have happened because it is human rights that are being attacked under the guise of something that does not exist.
All right, and I don't think we're going to be solving this anytime soon. I do have John who has a comment.
This is more in the form of a request, Tanya. Could we have somebody in from the various interested parties to come in here and talk about the Yorklands? Because I'm totally confused at the moment. There seems to be parties that are advocating for it to be a park, a national park. But lots of people have been hired, as an American company has been hired, to do the outline design work. I don't understand what's actually happening down there. I just wonder whether we could get some reps in here to discuss it from whatever sides that are taking part.
That is actually coming down the pipe. So that's one of our future topics.
I think it's incredibly valuable for us to discuss it. Brian Skerritt, are you still online? Do you have any comments on this? Because you would be a good first commentator, I believe, as you've really been putting your heart and soul in this.
Was the question related to the Fusion Lands development versus the National Urban Park? Okay, yeah, I understand that. So short answer is the province had initially said they were going to parcel out many parts of that land for sale. And that's when Yorklands Green Hub evinced some interest in a very specific part of it. Then the province changed gears and said, no, we're going to sell the whole thing. So it made it much more difficult for smaller interests like Yorklands to get a foothold. And then last year, they sold the parts west of the Aramasa River. So it's basically the corner of Victoria and Stone that was bought by Fusion Homes for Development. The balance of the property on York Road, which includes all the historic buildings, is still owned by the province. And behind that are sections that lead all the way to Stone Road that are owned by the city. So that's the separate portion that we're proposing should be a national urban park, which was one of 15 parks that were proposed to the Minister of the Environment or in his mandate letter. So that's the difference. There are actually two different things going on, and they don't conflict. In fact, in many cases, the urban park project should only enhance the Fusion Homes property values.
Thank you to Brian. Hopefully we will have people from Fusion Homes or perhaps representatives from Yorklands here to speak on the Yorklands at some future date. Glenn has a comment.
Earlier in the get-together this morning, there was some discussions about getting reliable news from what's happening around the world. And I'd just like to mention that there is a radio station in Britain. It's called Monocle, and I found them to be quite good. They provide all sorts of different topics, so if you're interested in fashion or if you're interested in food or whatever. They also have one that sort of covers politics and events happening around the world. There's four programs that I actually like to listen to. You can get it on podcasts. They're downloadable. There's one called The Briefing. There's another one called The Globalist, Foreign Affairs, and Monocle Daily. And I found them entertaining or interesting to listen to. The moderators get people that should know what the hell they're talking about. So you'll have they'll speak to diplomats. They'll speak to people on the ground. They'll speak to members of parliaments in countries, Finland, Sweden, Poland, all around the world. I found it very informative, and I believe it's credible information that they're passing along. So if you're interested, the radio station is Monocle. You can type in Monocle 24 on the if you go online, and it'll take you right to the site.
Let's hear what's happening in good old Guelph over the next little while.
Okay, we've got a council meeting on October 24th, starting at 6:30 p.m. And the items on the agenda include the Committee of the Whole Consent Report. Those items are emergency management, community grants, public art, and the culture plan. The items for discussion are the Parks and Recreation Master Plan, and Councillor Klassen is going to talk about a guaranteed livable income. Please have your say about the Emma to Earl Street Bridge. There are two proposed designs. Please choose which one you would like by October 24th. The College Avenue is going to have a protected cycling lane. Please share your input by November 8th. And the survey about the Downtown Heritage Conservation District study is now up. Next week on Breezy Breakfast, we're having some tales for the season featuring Bonnie Dirtnell, Susan Ratcliffe, and the Jay Walker. Bonnie has a new book out, and she will be bringing copies to the restaurant. They are available for $20 in cash. Coming soon on Breezy Breakfast, we'll be talking about the Baker District, Movember, food security, and what is going on with the OR lands. And with that, I believe it's a wrap. Thank you, everybody, very much for being here, and we'll see you next week.
That's all for today. Thanks for joining us for breakfast. Theme music by Jules Germ. Post-production by Scotty Hertz. Breezy Breakfast. Stop by for a refill anytime.